I'm Zach. I'm a musician, a former worship leader. I helped destroy Mars Hill Church. I'm not really sure what I believe anymore, and I am okay with that.
I'm Dave. I'm a Bible theology nerd, a movie buff. I've been searching my Bible all day for verses about not helping people with HIV, like the Texas judge just sadly ruled today.
Yeah, that is a time-sensitive reference.
Yeah. Today's September 7th. I didn't find anything. Oh, I'm an evangelical.
Yes. Well, I will grieve about that. This is Veterans of Culture Wars.
Veterans of Culture Wars is a podcast where we have conversations about evangelical Christianity. We welcome you to the podcast, whether you are a believer or not. And Zach, I guess this is our official welcome back fall. We had a summer behind us. It was a good summer for me.
Our third season. I believe this is officially the kickoff to our third season. I know it was only like 2 weeks ago that we released the episode with Matt Zoller-Seitz. That was supposed to be the last episode of the second season, so we'll consider it still that.
Okay, the official kickoff to our third season, I guess.
Yeah,
who's counting?
This is our kickoff potluck. I brought beans. What did you bring, Dave?
You
signed up.
I forgot to bring something.
Dave, come on.
Beans sound good. But you know what? I think we have a special guest who may have brought something to the VCW potluck.
Indeed. You normally don't require them to bring anything, but
She's very kind. So I think she was very generous.
Show. Maybe. Today, I don't know what we're talking about. Today we're going to be speaking with Mandy Capehart. She is a grief coach, author of the book Restorative Grief, and founder of the Restorative Grief Project. She also host the podcast Restorative Grief and the Uncomfortable Grace podcast. She and I have not met in real life, but we were in the same room together a few months ago. I guess it was a Billy Graham thing. why we didn't interact. But welcome to the show, Mandy.
Oh, thank you. For the record, I brought deviled eggs and dates stuffed with jalapenos and bacon. So I am prepared for this potluck.
Yeah, save me a couple of those.
You got it.
That sounds amazing.
Right?
Mandy, we usually kick off the show just asking people about their story with evangelical Christianity. So what's your history with the faith and how's that manifested in your life, I guess? Oh,
loaded questions, Dave.
Yeah.
Starting I love right off it. With the big one. Just hit it. I was not raised in evangelical culture. I was actually raised Lutheran. And it wasn't until I moved away for college, I moved in on campus, and I knew out of the gate, like, I don't want to get involved in party culture. We didn't have sororities or fraternities or anything, but I just was like, I want to be really careful about what I involve myself in. And so I ended up joining Campus Crusade for Christ in my sophomore year.
Crew.
It was absolutely, yeah, crew. We were a catalytic campus, so we didn't have any like adult staff. We were adults, what am I saying? But like paid staff to be there. So it's just us running it. And so, yeah, I made all of my close friends to this day. I met my husband at crew. I was a worship leader as well for about 16 years. I got married right out of college. We got married pretty young, like graduated, and the next year we got married. And ever since, we'd been leading worship together for a really long time. And so I have never really fit fully well in the evangelical culture because by nature, I'm kind of a dissenter. I tend to like hear a thing and say, I don't mean prove it, but I also mean like, you can't prove that I'm wrong either. Like there's no concrete evidence. And so whenever it would come to like outreach and ministry, and I went on with crew, side note, I did go on a missions trip, but it was just to Colorado. So I lived in Colorado for a summer with 31 other kids my age in a giant old shut down sorority house. Best summer ever.
Was it like to Boulder to reach the pot smoking hippies there in that town?
No, but I loved Boulder so much. I was like, I could live here in a heartbeat, for the record.
Okay.
We lived up in Fort Collins, and we were actually just running a summer camp for all of the staff of Campus Crusade, all their kids. So we watched their kids while they did all these 2 months of trainings. And so it was a very, for me, easy missions trip. I got to make some new friends and really enjoyed my time in Colorado. But the hardest part for me was at night, we would go out and have to evangelize the neighborhoods and talk to people. And like, I remember distinctly talking to one woman and being so angry with my situation because she was heartbroken. And I was sharing this word with her and praying with her. And then I was like, so I have to pass you off to a local church because I don't live here. And it made me so angry because I'm like, the whole purpose of this entire thing is to build community. And here I am saying, let me build a community that I'm not a part of. The one person you chose to trust right now, I'm leaving. And it just, it started me down this path of like outwardly questioning everything instead of keeping it internal. Which I lost a lot of friends for, to say the least. Or maybe they were like, nah, girl, we're not your friend because that's not who we are. And that's fine. So yeah, fast forward, it's been, 2022? I stepped down from leading worship in 2018. Ironically, after I went to Bethel for a worship university for 2 weeks, I just realized I couldn't do it anymore. So now I'm working kind of evangelical adjacent, trying to inform and educate and build grief literacy within the church. Because when my mom died in 2016, and the 4 years after that, before I wrote this book, were so traumatizing and so difficult and so frustrating because I was still heavily involved in my church and volunteering and present at everything. And I didn't know how to ask for help. And when I would ask for help, people who genuinely loved me didn't know how to show up for me. And that's not their fault. They just didn't know what would be helpful. They didn't know what to say. They didn't know what not to say. And so yeah. I very much, as a like challenger personality, decided I can do this. I can teach the church how to grieve. No small task, but that's kind of my mission at this point. That's my relationship to evangelicalism right now anyway.
You remind me of my sister, because after we lost our dad, she realized that like her boss wasn't equipped to deal with a direct report who was in grief. They hadn't lost anybody, and she had a difficult time at work. And then she started a consultancy to help companies deal with grieving employees.
Wow.
experiencing a lack of support in that area and identifying a need and trying to help out there.
She sounds great.
She is.
I like her already.
I really like my sister. I don't want to say that my church was bad at how they helped me. I mean, I didn't stay much longer after that, which was probably related. But I do remember, like, you know, I was playing worship there, and I was like, yeah, if I'm gonna play again, like, I don't want to be doing like good father, like, I don't want to be playing songs that are really about father relationships with God. Like, I don't want to end up just like crying on stage. Right. And I didn't like that song, but it would have probably made me cry.
I can relate to that. There was a song that we sang years before my mom died. I mean, I don't remember when it came out. It was a remake of I've got the joy down in my heart. It was I got the joy. And you're just shouting it. And it has other parts to it, but it was so popular. And every time I was asked to lead the song, I was crying like internally. And there was one time that I just said, I'm not going to do it. I couldn't do it. I was done because I had like encountered someone. And I knew everyone that we went to church with. It wasn't a huge church. And I'm looking at the faces in the front row, and I'm like, we're shouting down their sorrows. And I understand the heart behind it. I understand that we think we are breaking through strongholds, and we're declaring the goodness of the Lord, and we're engaging with worship that is warfare. I get all of that language. I also know the very visceral reality of deep-rooted pain that is going completely unnoticed mm-hmm. and being spiritually bypassed for the sake of a performance, for the sake of a Sunday morning, for the sake of keeping consistency for people who aren't in trauma. We are sacrificing that opportunity to be really in the dirt with people. And it just, that was kind of the start of my, I think I'm done leading worship. And I'm terrible at quitting things when I know I'm supposed to. Mm-hmm. I don't like to give up on things, but it lasted. That was a long journey to realizing like, this is no longer my arena and that's okay.
Do you feel like the evangelical church that you've been a part of, that we've been a part of? I mean, I think everybody enjoys the uplifting worship songs. It's good to sing with people and to feel good. And, you know, for me, a committed Christian, to worship God, and I get all that. But when it comes to this topic of grief, I think most people mean well. And as you talk about in your books, they may state verses to you kind of trying to be helpful, but it ends up not being helpful. Some of these verses are taken like way out of context. But I think what I'm getting at is there is this pressure in churches. There's this sense that we're all supposed to be happy because we know Jesus, right? Yeah. And we're supposed to project this radiant glow to all of our neighbors around. You know, we have to be happy. There's like this pressure. And so if we're sad and if something traumatic has happened, it's almost like this thing that leaders and other people just kind of, you know, not consciously think, but it's like we have to move this person along like really quickly. We have right. to get them to a point where they're happy again. And I'm just interested in your thoughts on that, what you have observed in the church, if you've observed those kinds of things, like trying to rush forward with grief because we have to be joyful and not really just sitting with somebody and trying to be empathetic and trying to even make an attempt to understand what's happened in their life that is crushing them.
Yeah. I want to answer that. I want to say something really quickly to what you said at the top of this is we all love singing together and being really happy. There's a neurological reason that's true, because our nervous systems connect with one another and our vagus nerve is activated when we are group singing. There are so many different things that you can do that engage your nervous system in a way that you're regulating with the people you're with. You sound like same mind. It's because you're literally training your body to resonate with these individual people in this situation. So that's one of the reasons that leading worship or being present in a worship session is so moving and emotional and evocative and engaging. It's also why it's really painful to pull away, because you realize there's more that's breaking than just your desire to worship. So that's a whole grief thing in and of itself. But to answer your question, the idea that we have to move quickly through loss and we spiritualize things that maybe were important to us, like it's kind of like having a baby, right? You guys have never physically had babies, but I have. And you forget how painful it is after the fact, like later down the road. I think that's one of those like pieces of creation that allows us to go and do it again, even though that was the scariest thing I've ever experienced in my life. And I think the same is true with grief. When we have walked through incredible loss and found comfort in scriptures, in resources, in people, in rituals, we internalize that because it was so meaningful to us. And when others are then in a similar boat, we think, guys, I've got life jackets. Let me toss these to you, because they were meaningful to us. We lack the awareness that says, can I ask what might be meaningful for you in your grief process? We lack the ability to pause and take ourselves out of the narrative. Because if I were to say to you, hey, Dave, I heard you lost your friend. This scripture was really meaningful to me. May I share it with you? You would have the opportunity to then consent to that kind of a conversation. Whereas I have experienced many times over people just walking up and saying, they're with the Lord now. You can rejoice. Everything is going to be okay. That's not true. You don't know that everything's going to be okay. That's my current soapbox, is people saying, it's going to be okay. You don't know that. It might not be. And our definitions yeah. of okay might be very different. So that spiritualizing of grief is not a bad thing. Like I started out really saying like, hey, all of scriptures are platitudes because they become statements that are meaningless. I don't actually think that's true. However, if something is meaningful to you, that does not automatically mean it will carry meaning for me. Even if we both say we carry the same faith or we believe the Bible, we probably believe different versions. We believe different applications. Like we're all so individual that our experience of what is comforting or what is meaningful or encouraging during grief is going to be as individual as our stories themselves.
I think art, music helps us understand a wide range of experience before we experience it ourselves. And worship in church is so often said that our model for that is the Psalms. Well, what do we have in the Psalms? There's songs of praise and songs of joy and songs of lament. At some point, I feel like songs of lament became outlawed in church. And I think it has something to do with the evangelistic nature of, well, if somebody new is here, they need to see that we're all happy because we have the joy of the Lord. But I remember when I started going to Mars Hill, that was one of the things that attracted me to there was they had songs of lament. And I was like, I connect with these feelings. These are real feelings that I have in life. And going to my previous churches where it was just song of joy and praise after song of joy and praise, I was just, this is not real to me. And I wonder if songs of lament were more common in church, if that would help churches be more ready for grief when it comes.
I mean, I can speculate, and I would assume that you're probably close to something right there, because the moment you walk into a room and you can sense that someone is heavy-hearted, there's empathy that grows. It's the same thing I was saying earlier. Like you are stirred to draw closer to those people. There's compassion that's allowed space. And I do have to say, like the church that my family and I have been a part of for the last decade or so, they are incredibly empathetic, loving, beautiful people. On the whole, the organization lacks the empathy, or not empathy, lacks the language around long-term processing of loss and learning to integrate that into who we are as individuals, rather than just saying, oh, we grieved, now we're healed, we moved on.
Right.
I take a lot of struggle. That's not the word. I take umbrance with the phrase.
Umbrage.
Yes. Yeah. I take Dolores Umbrage and I to the phrase sight goes to healing. Sight then healing. People say it in my circle. I don't know about you, Dave, but I hear it constantly. And I'm like, no, sight does not go to healing. If I'm a doctor and I see someone is bleeding out, I can't be like, cool, I see your problem. You're healed. There's steps in between that we're missing. And one of the things that I have worked really hard, and this includes incorporating opportunities to lament, to sit and to break your heart open and be honest without trying to resolve it, without immediately trying to say, yay, I'm healed. It's recognizing like, yeah, you have sight. You can see that there's something off balance. Something is out of alignment in who you are and what you're experiencing in your life. But if you do not take time to gain insight about what that is, what that means for you, what it actually would look like to come back toward alignment for you and back toward your values and what those can mean for your overall process and healing and ability to be a human, then you can't ever take action on behalf of yourself. And it's action that leads us into healing. But if it's empty action, if it's just singing the praise songs because they make us feel happy for the moment, and then we leave and we're depressed or isolated, or lonely, or confused, or grieving, or truly in pain, then we've missed the whole point. Like, and I think that that's where those songs of lament have to be handled with such intelligence when it comes to presenting them to a group of people. Because if you walk into an environment and say, I'm going to lead us into this raw, emotionally open space, and I'm going to ask you to be vulnerable, you have to be really honoring and willing to not only model that yourself, but also know how to steward that really well without again, just resulting in spiritual bypassing and trying to like, okay, cool, where it's 12 o'clock and we have, you know, lunches to get to. So wrap it up.
Could you explain what spiritual bypassing is for folks who don't know?
Yeah. So essentially the simplest form of explaining that is it's saying that God will be with you no matter what. You don't have to process this or you don't have to worry about this. So it's this idea that because you have a hope in Jesus, you have no reason to despair now. When the truth is, hope and despair can exist in the same breath. Two things can be true. Two things can actually be experienced. And I, every time I say that, people soften. It's like they've been waiting to hear someone say, it's okay to be really relieved that your person died, but also really heartbroken. Because those seem incongruous. But the truth is, my grandfather passed away, oh my gosh, 2 years ago. I was so relieved because he'd been unwell for a long time and he'd been in a home for a long time and he was struggling. And the relief that his death brought to my grandmother was immeasurable, but I was still sad to gutted to lose my grandfather. And I think spiritual bypassing really just takes this form of like, everything's going to be okay. So back to business as usual. God is with you. You can be patient. You can just wait until the healing comes. And it puts us into this really passive positioning in our own healing process, which is anybody who has ever just said, no, I'm not really feeling any grief right now. I'm like, yeah, but you might have just like some latent past behind you, like squashed back grief that you probably are going to get hit with soon. And that's going to suck. So, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Is that clear enough?
Yeah. So, I mean, essentially it dismisses people's very real concerns and minimizes the issues that they're bringing up and with spiritual language that sort of allows you to get off the hook from doing anything to actually help this person. Yeah. It's sort of related to our former guest, Jazz Robertson, taught me on Twitter about the term thought terminating cliches. Mm-hmm. So those don't have to be always spiritual, but one of those discussion ending statements that just kind of like, well,
it is what it is. Yeah. Exactly.
Or, you know, everything has a reason. God's got a plan.
Yeah.
The spiritual bypassing or thought terminating cliche that I heard from my mom when my dad died was, well, it was his time to go.
Yeah.
And I reject that 100%.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It was said more to help her than to help her kids who she said that to. That's what she needed to hear.
Yes.
To not deal with it.
To avoid it. 100%. That is, so in my language, we say that's centering. If you have three people who are grieving the loss of one person, they're actually grieving three different people, right? Mm-hmm. Like that makes sense. They have different relationships. Yeah. One person in an attempt to comfort the others may inadvertently center their grief and what they're experiencing right in the story of someone else and do exactly that. Bypassing something, trying to be like idealistic or overly positive or like appearing to rise above their emotional state in order to be okay for the sake of their kids. And that could be, I mean, there's so much sincerity in that, you know, like they're doing the best they can with what they have in that moment. Does that make it okay? No. Does that make it helpful? Obviously not. But when we take that moment of recognition, and of course, later in life, like as a kid or even as a young adult, you have no, especially in the moments of acute grief when everything is very fresh, you have no framework to like step back and give yourself a pep talk of like, okay, let's be rational. They're in the middle of their own loss and they can't be my person right now, and that's okay. But I do think that's where we have to recognize and start talking about grief in a way that allows us to, instead of over-identifying with our grief and our emotions, be able to take a moment back and be like, oh, I'm not angry. I'm seeing anger. That's really interesting. And start to cultivate some what I call compassionate curiosity. And of course, that's not, again, like a off the bat, like the first week my mom, after my mom died, I allowed myself to be very numb. Like I actively said, okay, we're going numb. We're going quiet, radio silence internally for 7 days. Whatever it looks like, we're getting through this week. And then we will decide if we're going to remain in this weird stasis or if we're going to engage again. And I mean, I had an actual, knockdown drag out with God where I just said, it's either I'm all in or I'm done, because I am so beyond pissed at everything that has just happened and the long sordid story of how what led to my mom even getting sick. Just, I was beside myself. And so I was like, well, let's just, you know what? Let's try all in, because we can certainly pull all out at some point and be done. But let's try all in and see what happens. So, I mean, you have the book, so that's what happened.
I wanted to ask you, in your book, you talk about the five stages of grief, which we're all familiar with: denial, anger, bargaining, depression.
She just gave a thumbs down.
Acceptance. Yes, thumbs down. Audience, she gave. And it's like, you know, you think about the acceptance point. And it's like, you know, does our society say you graduate from the grieving process or something as you go through this linear fashion of what grief is supposed to look like? But I was wondering, you know, because I think we've all heard that. Not all churches adopt it, but some definitely do. What is the faulty reasoning in this process? And why is it potentially harmful to people?
Fabulous question, Dave. I'm so glad you asked. I'd love to answer that for you. It wasn't created for grievers. It was the five stages of death were initially what they were. They're created, it was an observational conclusion that these five emotional states, rational emotional states, were what terminally ill patients were going through. So as they were given their diagnosis, they went through the process of denial. They were angry. They started bargaining. God, if you'll just, and then I will, if you can spare me, I promise I will devote myself, whatever bargaining there was. There's depression of, I can't change this. Oh my God, I'm actually going to die. And then there became this sense of acceptance, which was being observed in, again, people who were dying. It was never designed or created to be the support system for people who were actively grieving. And so my premise, the purpose of including that in the book, was simply as a road of familiarity, wanting to create something that feels okay and kind of safe to approach, because we are familiar with those five words. But for me, restoration became step six immediately. I have always but this was before, of course, that I knew, oh, those weren't actually meant for grievers. The sixth step to me said, well, I have to do something with this. There's no, and I want you to be very clear, like, I don't mean I have to create purpose from my pain, because that is a very, very toxic way of approaching our losses and even trying to serve ourselves on the other side of it. But that's a whole different conversation. The idea of restoration is this recognition that we can then, after we come to this place of radical acceptance of things that we cannot control, what do we do with that? How do we actually integrate the truth that there are things we can't control? Life is impermanent. Everything is ephemeral. What are we going to do with ourselves? Are we just going to float despondent now for the rest of our lives and feel like half connected and half detached and honestly just spiraling? Or are we able to spiral upwards? And this idea of expanding as we grow and learn and including what really served well as we grow and learn. And so restoration is the ongoing act of healing. It's this decision to continually wrestle as we go back in and out of all the different stages and different parts of our lives and experience the range of emotions within depression and the range of emotions within bargaining and the range of thoughts within our anger. It's all so much bigger and more mysterious isn't really the word, but it's harder to understand than we want it to be. And that's infuriating for sure, but it doesn't mean it's an impossible thing to pursue. I just think that we get very caught up on, okay, we want closure so that we can move on. And that language is very easy to justify with spiritual language. It's very easy to write on a greeting card, And it's very easy to postulate and say like, okay, cool, I did it. I grieved. I got closure. I have moved on.
I got the merit badge.
I have the badge sewn on my sash. Thank you for my trophy. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, at least for those of us that are like problem solvers by nature, it can be really hard to come to grips with the nonlinear path that grief puts us on. I'll say you've mentioned anger a few times. I would like to, in a bit, talk about the emotions, feelings, the impact on our brains of going through grief. But before doing that, I was wondering if we could talk a bit about the varieties of grief themselves. We've talked previously on this show about ambiguous grief. What's the other term for that?
Disenfranchised
grief. So as something that often is experienced when people like their faith community collapses or something like that. Not a death of somebody close to them, but a loss of community identity. Maybe they've moved across the country and don't really have a way to stay in contact with loved ones anymore. So people are not dead, but they're disconnected. And it makes for it a difficult grieving process. So another type by way of example, today was the first day of school for my kids. It wasn't as hard for me as it has been in the past, but I've always struggled with viewing milestones for my kids, rather than being just exciting, being reminders of the closing window I have of time left with them living in my house, part of my life day in and day out. I'm always like doing the math, seeing what percent of their childhood is over, how many years I am from my dad's age, when he died, things like that. Mm. I think it's fair to say that's anticipatory grief, of like already grieving my children's eventual not needing me in their life all the time. So I'm wondering if you could talk about anticipatory grief and some of the other forms of grief that people may not be familiar with, if they're listening to this and thinking that grief is what you do when somebody dies and you're sad.
Yeah, I am so glad you brought this up. Those two, disenfranchised and anticipatory grief, I think are some of the most common that people don't realize they're experiencing. I'm a really big fan of letting people know, like, hey, anger as an emotion is secondary. It's masking something else behind it that it's protecting you from. And that's okay. But maybe get a little bit curious, because when you can figure out what it's hiding behind, or what's hiding behind your anger, you're going to move in such different ways toward yourself and toward others. And this is where recognizing that you're grieving is so powerful. So anticipatory grief, like you said, it's that idea that I know someone's dying. When my mom told me she had cancer, I went into action mode and my sister fell apart. We're very different in that regard. And it was so typical. And yet the entire time I was trying to count the days, anticipating what was coming, trying to prepare, trying to not screw up, right? Not make the mistakes, because I didn't have a chance to do a redo. And so that level of grief isn't just connected to death. Anticipatory grief can be like, I know the school year is coming to an end. I relate so big on feeling like, oh, my kid is going to move out soon. She's 8. She's not moving out anytime soon. And yet I'm like, a decade is going to pass so quickly. I don't know what I'm going to do with myself.
How am I going to do all the things that I wanted to do as a parent in the amount of time I have left to do them?
Exactly.
Impossible.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. That's a whole nother conversation. But yeah, so that anticipatory grief, disenfranchised grief is that feeling like people are not validating your loss, because it's something that maybe because it's not a suicide, then it's not worth grieving as much if it was just a natural death of a grandparent, which is garbage. It doesn't matter what the type of grief is. If it matters to you, then it matters. If it matters, let it matter. And so disenfranchised grief is often connected to like job loss, or when you quit a job, or when you end a relationship. And that it's so easy to write off, and we minimize our own losses in this area so often because we're trying to fit in, because we're trying to appear calm or connected or fine or like unaffected, as if being affected is a mark that we're not the right kind of human for this world, which.
Yeah. I think disenfranchised grief is probably something that is extremely common for those in the deconstruction space.
Big time. Having lost
their identity and that connection to a higher purpose or whatever, all the friendships they had at their church, all of that stuff. And I think I interrupted you. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no, you're fine. You're absolutely right. It was actually something that really drew me into the deconstruction community, if it can be called that, just because, like I said, I've always wrestled and pushed back on anything that someone says is black and white true. I'm like, BS, here's gray space. Here's 32 examples of gray space. And grief is such a gray space that it was really easy for me to allow people to fall apart when it came to faith, even though I still profess to be a Christian. I still have faith in Jesus. I can easily understand where they're coming from because I love to pick it all apart myself. And so even if someone picks it all apart and lands with just puzzle pieces that they're willing to throw away, I'm like, all right, now let's process what's going to come next, because there are going to be multiple secondary losses from choosing to walk away from a church. So like, if we say, I'm not going to attend this church anymore, I'm still living in the same city, but I'm going to go to this church. Okay. The primary loss, I'm not attending that church anymore. So my rituals of a Sunday morning, right? But it's also the connection to people, because we all know that proximity makes relationships a hell of a lot easier. And no one intentionally is forgetting about you, but they don't see you every Sunday. So it's a lot harder to reach out, to build connection. It was convenient when we were present. And, you know, even if it was an hour once a week, actively with one another, an hour once a week. Yeah. Secondary losses then carry on past that, because you realize like, oh, well, actually, we also had like a girls' trip that we did all fall, every fall, and they didn't invite me this year. That's really weird, because we have connection outside of church. It's just all the little things that start to add up to one another, or add up, that become so overwhelming. And the deconstruction community is already one that is willing to say, I have no idea, and it hurts, and I don't know what to do about it. So what you might not know about me, I'm an Enneagram 8, if you care about Enneagram at all. And I am filled with a like fire of injustice and rage when people who are wounded are being actively wounded. I mean, you see my hand like went into a claw. I did not do that on purpose. I just am like, started thinking about some people that I care about who have been vilified or attacked or criticized simply for asking questions. And it just infuriates me, because I'm like, didn't Jesus ask like thousands of questions? I'm pretty sure like he was constantly asking questions, not for the purpose of gaining that information. Like, let's be clear. He was not trying to get an actual answer for himself. He was pressing back on us, on his audience's assumptions and their conclusions. And so I have such a tender heart for people who are choosing to say, my faith isn't making sense right now, and I need to re-examine my beliefs. Because faith and beliefs are different things, totally different things. And I think that when we recognize, oh, I can actually carry a faith in something and have completely different beliefs than all the people around me, that is also a source of loss. Like, oh, I used to relate in a lot of ways, and now I'm not really sure how to relate because what I believe is so different than what they believe, but we still have the same faith foundations. Now I don't know what to do. So it just pisses me off that so many people refuse to be a safe space for someone that is like openly wounded and honestly expressing themselves about it.
Even the people who still are committed Christians and still attending church, I think through the Trump era and the post-Trump era, the disenfranchised kind of felt with just what you now said, Mandy, where the beliefs are different. Maybe the faith is in common, but there's different political beliefs, different views, everything came to a head, it seems like, in a lot of ways in this past era for that disenfranchised grief. Zach, did you want to stay on that topic? I had a question about anticipatory grief, but go ahead.
I was just wanted to say, like, I'm just thinking of the amount of times I've seen negative stuff said about people that are deconstructing, specifically that, you know, they're doing it because it's the cool, popular thing to do. And like, all right, you know, a lot of this is people with religious trauma. And the last thing that we want when we're already traumatized is to add grief into the mix. It's not a fun combination. But just as grief is not something that you go through the steps and then you're done, it pops up in surprising ways. And, you know, if anybody has moved while attending a church, you know that the word gets out and people from your church come and help you.
Yeah.
Once if you've then moved after deconstructing, what happened? You moved yourself, or you hired movers, didn't you?
It's funny you say that, because that is like the last time we moved, it was an incredible like act of God. We were packing our things and we'd invited a bunch of friends, and my one friend who is very similar to me, but he's bigger and louder, he showed up and I knew I could stop. I just was able to rest because he absolutely orchestrated the whole thing. And I was like, they love us. I know they love us. If we had to move, I don't know if it would be a priority. And that's a real, like, these are people I still care about. I see them. I talk to them every now and then. But I don't know. And that itself, you're right. It's another just like, oh, damn. Okay. Maybe that is something I need to sit with and grieve and be honest about, because it's not, it doesn't seem fair. But at the same time, and I try to take a lot of responsibility for myself when I've pulled back, because I have pulled back from these relationships. Not necessarily in the last 4 years, not necessarily because they've done anything or said anything, but out of a need for my own level of self-protection, my own time to heal, out of the fact that we're in a pandemic and everybody's pulling back, like for lots of reasons, but it still does, like, okay, but I'm also not attending church consistently in person. So out of sight, out of mind.
I wanted to circle back to anticipatory grief. Because I feel like for myself, I've had a relatively easy life up until this point.
Yeah.
My grandparents have all passed away, and there was certainly grief in that. Grandpa on my dad's side died when I was like 7. So I have a few kind of vague memories of him when I was really younger. His wife, my grandma, Jean, huge Elvis fan. I just saw that movie, which was, you know, okay, pretty good, I guess, the other night. But, you know, she died probably 10 or 11 years ago. And then the grandparents on my mom's side, my grandma died of Alzheimer's. And that is probably the most intense grief from the loss of a person that I have felt. Because it's kind of what you said earlier, Mandy. It's not just that she passed away. It was like the whole process. And seeing what it did to my grandpa, who was always, you know, he was a truck driver. He was a man's man, FDR Democrat, you know, an environmentalist without being an environmentalist, you know, and to see how that destroyed him was really, really hard. And I was, you know, probably like 12 years old when it started. So it was one of those, as I was becoming a teenager, it left that imprint on my mind. And there still is grief today that my kids can't know any of my grandparents. But all of that being said, my parents are still alive. They're celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary as we are recording this on a cruise. My in-laws are still alive. My children are healthy. My wife, Michelle, is healthy. That's where I kind of feel like I've led an easy life, because I haven't gone through like another significant loss yet. But it kind of feels like when I have these conversations, it's on the horizon. It feels ominous. It's coming. So for people like me, you know, how do you prepare for that? Because kind of what Zach was saying about his kids, you want to enjoy life. You want to have the moments of joy and happiness with family. We're all here now. That's a grace. But there still is a reality of what's inevitably coming.
Yeah. Such a good question. And I have so many thoughts. So let's see if I can keep them straight for you. I think the most powerful thing we can offer ourselves in this in this environment is what you just said, is excessive amounts of grace. Because you might say, you can frame that you've had an easy life, but the truth is you've experienced a lot of loss. It might not be death. There have been a ton of things in your story that if you look back with a fine-tooth comb, that you will experience differently from this perspective, because you are now a different person and you have new information than who you were when you were going through those losses, right? But when it comes to anticipatory grief, I think that grief literacy is really the only way we can start to even give ourselves a foundation, because there's no level of like experience in my life that I could ever do for as a grief professional, as a coach, as a whatever in someone else's life that is actually going to equip me for the next loss, for the next massive shift, because they're all different. However, the fact that I have some mental health education, that I have mindfulness education, that I have a lot of information and practice just showing up and holding space for people, bearing witness. Bearing witness is so much different to me than holding space. And I think when we hold space, we say, I hear you. That's awful. I'm with you. When we bear witness, we listen to the story, we gain empathy, we express empathy, and we actually enter into, without like making it weird and making it about like us and telling our stories, bearing witness means we're like, I'm with you. Not just for this moment where you're being honest and vulnerable. I'm with you when this sucks again in a week. I'm with you. Whether you need me there or not, like I will be present. And becoming present, it's a theme I hit on in the book because it's something that is so difficult. We are either future-oriented people who struggle with anxiety and anticipation and tension of trying to control what's coming. We are past-oriented people who ruminate and meditate on what was and daydream about what it could have been if something hadn't happened. And the few among us who can truly be present are like signposts to me, because when it comes to preparing ourselves for grief, being able to be really in the moment and allowing ourselves to radically accept that this is an ephemeral moment, that this precious moment is never coming again, this moment right now, we can't redo this. So when we're done with it, it will become a guidepost that if that was something that brought me joy, that was a piece of my life story that was so monumental, I want that again. I can choose to recognize, yeah, that's not coming back. But I also now know, man, those are the types of experiences I want to chase down in my life. And I think for me, we've got chronic illness in our family. I knew all of my great grandparents, all my great grandmothers. So I lost all of them. Lost grandfather after grandfather. And my mom and friends, classmates, neighbors, so many people. Every one of them led me to this place where I had to, again, wrestle with the fact that my family is getting smaller and smaller and there's not much I can do about it. How do I actually then intentionally engage with them and show up and become present and have really hard conversations? Because I think that's a big part of being present, especially with family. Just have the hard conversations without living in this anxiety that I'm not going to do it right, or I'm not going to say the right thing, or I'm not going to end everything on a good note. I think because it's worth it to me to be really authentic, even when it causes like strife or arguments. Because of the fact that like, I don't know if I'm going to leave and see you again. And I want to be honest. I don't want to get to the end of this or lose one of us and have regrets. So planning for me looks like just having opportunities, or rather taking opportunities, to bear witness to other people and to just observe and to see like, what are death rituals in other countries? Like, what is my family's relationship to loss? Like, are we comfortable talking about this? Does anybody have a will? Does anybody know like what happens after we die physically? Like, what do we do with the body? What do we do with the ashes? Which one is it? does someone want to be a tree? Earlier today, somebody told me there's like this new like funeral ritual where the person is just sitting upright. The body of the person is sitting upright, drinking a beer and like enjoying a party all around them with their family. And I was like, that's a fascinating ritual. Who in the family is comfortable with that? I can tell you my grandmother would be like, yes, she wants to be stuffed and put in our living room to observe us till the end of time. And we're like, not a chance. Absolutely
not. My wife doesn't
not.
Approve my requested ritual. I saw like an Amazonian tribe that like takes the ashes of the dead person and mixes a very small ratio of them into a community stew. And then everybody takes a sip. And
you know, I will be with you always.
Yeah. Or at least for the next 24 hours or so.
Yeah, there you go.
And she didn't like that idea. Thinking of holding space, bearing witness, you know, those two ideas. I have a really cool story from recently. So after my dad died, I had a really hard time and needed to talk to people. And I'm somebody that talks to people to charge my batteries. And, you know, I'm more extroverted than my wife. And you know, there was a point where she hadn't been through this. She knew that, you know, she could make sure that I would eat and bathe and things like that, but there was only so much that she could do, and she knew that I needed to talk to a friend. She encouraged me to text a few friends, see who was available. One very quickly, you know, he had plans. He's like, cancel them, come on over, we'll hang out. And we just hung out in his backyard, and he just let me talk about what my dad was, what he meant to me, why I missed him, what I loved about him. He had met my dad a few times. We were housemates at one point. And then I had another friend that didn't even know him super well. But his wife had lost a parent several years before. And so he was a little bit more familiar with the process, and he could see that I needed an opportunity to talk. And he invited me over, and I hung out in his backyard for hours, and we just did the same thing, just talked about, you know, I was in that headspace where like all I'm thinking about and all I want to talk about is my dad, and it's bizarre to me that everybody else doesn't feel the same way. That's where my brain was at. And so this past weekend I went to see a couple shows, see some bands play, some, you know, old friends and things. And so that was Friday and Saturday night. I went to two different shows, and I had just finished reading your book. And so in a 24-hour span at the separate shows, I ran into both of those guys and was able to just tell them, hey, remember when you had me come over and we just hung out and I just talked about my dad for hours? That was incredibly important in my grief process. And what you did for me there was so powerful, and you may not remember it as being that way for you, but it was for me. And I want you to know that. And I want you to know how much I've appreciated that ever since. And it was really cool for me to be able to tell them that, and really cool for them. I could just see how happy it made them to know that they'd made a positive impact in my life. It was just, it was moving for the both of us.
And I think that's beautiful.
It really was. It really was. And so I guess the question I could lead into is you've talked a little about holding space and bearing witness, but I guess how can friends help grievers? What are some things that they can do?
I think being willing to be that person is obviously one of those first things they can do, by saying, I'm available to you. And we're all really comfortable with saying, like, let me know whatever you need, right? Easy thing to say, really crappy thing to say, to be honest, because anytime I've been like grieving and needing someone to do something, I have no concept of what I need. you're giving me homework to figure out what I need? No, thank you. I'm not interested. But when I am at the point of being able to, like you were, say, I need to reach out to someone, I love knowing, okay, I can call this person up. They will probably drop everything. I go into those moments with clear instructions for them in like a, all I need is to listen, is for you to listen. I just need you to hold me. I just need you to listen to my story. I don't need you to fix anything. I don't need you to have any answers. I just need to be heard. I think inherently people know that. I think it takes a lot of maturity to be able to be quiet and just listen, as opposed to trying to fix or correct things. Certainly someone who's a professional in that arena struggles to just listen a lot of times when I hear things repeated and I want to show up on their behalf. But I think as grief supporters, we have an obligation to defer to the person who's grieving, no matter what it is. So our understanding of what is meaningful takes a backseat. Our anecdotes take a backseat. Our experience, like when I had a miscarriage at the start of 2020 and I kept really quiet about it because we were in a freaking pandemic and everybody had their problems. But I was very angry because I'm like, no, 2020 is my crappy year. What's everybody else doing? Yeah. I don't think so. But anytime I did mention it, people say, oh yeah, I've had like 6 miscarriages. It's okay. And here's my opinion about it. Or it's nothing at all. It's just a bunch of cells. Or I can't believe you had a miscarriage. Did you name the baby? Did you have a spiritual experience, like a funeral for them? Like the range. And I'm just trying to say like, everything sucks. And I also had this happen. I was just trying to be honest. But so grief supporters, I think, do themselves an incredible credit by, same thing I said earlier, just learning more about what is meaningful for people in grief and getting to know our people is really important. Like, we think we know people and then we try and help them and we realize, oh, I don't know you at all because that pissed you off and I had no idea. So I think becoming so curious about our friends and the people that we want to support is huge. And I will say this last thing too about that. In the church, it's really, really interesting because the emphasis on service, the emphasis on, you know, generously giving of yourself, of setting up a meal train. I do love that habit. I love when people are like, yeah, can I bring you dinner? Yeah, absolutely. You can. Just tell me when. But like it's has to be invited. We have to get consent and ask permission to step into someone's most vulnerable, scary moments of their lives. Cause that's what we're doing when we say, I see you, I see your grief. I think it's really interesting too on Twitter. So like church spaces are learning how to do it a little bit. But on Twitter, it's funny because you'll see a lot of people just kind of shouting at the void, really wanting to be seen and heard. And I have a love-hate relationship with it because I see that and I'm like, okay, I don't have any relationship with that person, but all they're getting is a bunch of hug emojis. Shit. That is the last thing that's going to show. And maybe to a degree that will help, like they feel a little bit seen, but there's so much in me that has to sit and decide like, who are the people in the close circle with this person? Like, who are they interacting with? And how can I encourage this small group to say like, actually, that was a big red flag. Reach out to them. I don't have a relationship. I'm not their coach. I'm not their counselor. I'm not their professional, but you have a relationship. Engage. And I think that that's one thing as a grief supporter too, like we have an obligation to the very few people that we are close to. We do not have an obligation to everyone around us. Just because we're in a church with all these people does not mean I need their story. I don't need all the details to be able to pray for them. I don't need to know anything about what happened in their life. If I want to genuinely show up and love them and support them through their losses, I can be selfless. It's going to cost me something. And that's, I think that's the mark of a true, like learning to be a grief supporter is it's going to cost you, whether it's money, time, whether it's your pride of thinking, you know, what grievers need. Like every single time someone else is in a grief event in my life, I'm like, come on, brain, don't freeze. You can do this without causing harm. I'm going to go ask questions if they need me as a resource. I'm like, not even going to, I don't even offer people my book. I'm like, I have resources when you need them. I'm here and I'm available, but I know I'm not your person. So like, I don't feel obligated to work with me, don't feel obligated to access me in any way. About a year ago, we had our pastor's brother died of COVID. Was it a year? It was a year ago. And it was horrifying. And he's my age, a little bit older, and unexpected, and just the worst. And it destroyed our community. And our pastors are incredibly, they're husband and wife, and they are incredibly intelligent, emotionally accessible, like healthy, spiritually healthy people. And I've remember speaking with them a few times after losing him and speaking with other people in the community and just recognizing, like, you're about to see these two lead so well. Take notes. These two are about to, like, increase their ability to lead through this incredibly painful time in our generation. And it's going to be so beautiful. Well, not too long ago, someone else reached out that it was also connected to him and was someone I've known for a long time, but they just now finally decided, like, I want to work with you or in some capacity. And I was like, that's awesome. Great. You're absolutely welcome. I'm hopeful that you don't feel obligated because we're in the same community. And they were very clear. They're like, no, I just can't do it by myself anymore. I'm like, great. I have resources for you, but I would never shove them. Like, I didn't just go up to everybody and be like, here's my book. Here's my book. Here's my card. Here's my podcast. Here's all of my resources. It's BS, you know? And I think that there's an authentic way to actually support people that we care about. But it starts with curiosity and it starts with the willingness to give without expectation or obligation.
Toward the end of your book, you have a chapter, Restorative Grief, the title of your book. And there was a quote that I have from that chapter that was meaningful. You say, quote, grief trashes our present to the point where we are grasping for our future and excavating our past, as if we can uncover something we miss that will restore the gift of today. Such a belief leaves our present hopeless. There is neither the promise nor the reality. Yet this wrong belief can turn our faith into a battlefield instead of a source of restoration. In order to find peace, we need to embrace the promise of hope in our daily lives as a reality, not only as something to come, but how can we embrace our present when we still experience triggers on a daily basis? So with a person who is in grief, what are some of the non-sentimental ways that they can embrace hope, like a genuine hope? Kind of like you said earlier, you can have hope and despair at the same time. You know, those can be two things that can be held. So how do they hold on to that while going through this pain or something that this seems impossible to navigate?
One of the things that is very important to me in grief work is being trauma informed. Because I think that we, at least in my experience, have witnessed a lot of people who want to do this amazing work with grievers, but are not trauma informed. And so they're not recognizing what's actually going on inside someone's body, like neurologically, when they are in grief, when they're in reactionary mode. And so mindfulness practices that engaged your nervous system so that you can find a sense of stability where you're at is really where I start. And so the first thing I teach people is about their window of tolerance. So the window of tolerance is this just concept that says when things are easy breezy, your window is wide open. You can be working and handle an interruption. So it's like an easy day at work. Someone says, hey, can you come to this meeting? No problem. Finish what I'm doing. Get up. No real like emotional responses, no like visceral responses, no thoughts of, I hate this job, I'm quitting. When you are in dysregulation, so your window has closed, you either become into a state of hypoarousal or hyperarousal. One, you are explosive. That person interrupts and you're like, are you kidding me, Dave? I really need to get this done. You asked me for this report and now you want me to come to a meeting, right? So volcano or iceberg, you turn into this slow, internal, like numb, just detached state of being. And so neither one of those states of being is fruitful for healing, for remaining present, or for experiencing any sense of hopefulness. And one of the things I tell my clients to look for as we're working together long-term is pay attention to the places in your life where you are triggered, where you historically have always been triggered by Dave coming to your desk with a memo. Watch for the moment when you respond a little differently. It doesn't have to be huge, but 0.5% differently is healing. 0.5% is a difference that you need to celebrate, because that is a sign that you have hope, that you can get another 0.5%. And so the way we make moves in mindfulness and make a way forward for our nervous system to like regulate and for our window of tolerance to open again, which to be fair, like even my window is open, shut all the time. That's everybody. Is to do things that bring ourselves back into the present moment. So I'm a big fan of anything that engages the vagus nerve. It's that nerve that runs from the base of your spine to the bottom of your spine, and it just connects all of your systems together. It's activated by group singing. It's activated by like cold plunges. I will go and like run my hands under cold water. All of these things are bringing my physical awareness back to the present moment. And so one of the things that, another thing that I say is that we are a whole being, mind, heart, body, and spirit, right? And so in grief, all of those are out of alignment. Identifying all of those different areas, our thoughts, our emotions, our physical sensations that we're feeling, and our connection to ourselves and to others and to God and the world. As they are out of alignment, we recognize that there are little things we can do, like eating something that we love that feeds our body, or recognizing that there's an ache in our back and giving ourselves a moment to stretch. Noticing that our thoughts are swirling with anxiety, trying to run forward to resolve something that's unresolvable, and seeing that thought and actually answering it back with, well, I could make a plan for when I die, but I'm at the McDonald's line. So I think I'll just take a minute and think about what I'd like to order in this present moment. It sounds so silly, but it's little things that really bring you into the physical presence of where you are in your body that allow you to embody your body, which we don't do most of the time. Most of the time, we're just using it as a vehicle to move. And I think the more that we practice little mindfulness tricks, like listening to something that is soothing, or eating something that we appreciate, or thinking a kind thought, asking someone else to say a kind word to us, or recognizing our connectedness, like to the soil. I love to put my hands in dirt. It's just, it feels amazing, and it's so good for you. It's what invites our body back into that present moment. And that is how we allow ourselves to feel hope again. When we can feel in control of our present moment and in control of how we are moving through the world, we recognize that we're safe. We're recognizing that we can be in control of ourselves to a degree and to how we respond to things around us. And I mean, to me, that is so hopeful. To me, that says, wow, there's a lot of things in this world I have no ability to control, none whatsoever. I can control where I'm standing right now. If I have that autonomy, I can control that. And that alone can give me some hope about like, okay, well, then where do I want to be standing? Because right now I'm standing around people that make me feel like garbage and that minimize my pain and really make me feel unsafe. I'm going to go stand near people that make me feel settled.
I've definitely done a lot of that. Like, what are the things that I can control? You mm-hmm. know, talking about like, where am I going to be standing? Thinking of anticipatory grief like that. I'm like, well, that's, you know, so much of that is because I'm not thinking about the present. I'm thinking about the future, which I can't control. And so much of the time, you know, we all tend to be worried about the future or reliving the past. And neither of those are real. The only thing that's real is the present. The others are just abstracts, and you know, eventually we'll get there, but when we get there, we'll be in the present there. And the present is what we can control. Earlier I said that I wanted to talk a bit about some of the feelings, some of the things going on in the brains of grievers. And I wanted to talk about that a bit. I'm thinking of grief guilt. I'm thinking of grief brain. I'm wanting to talk about some of these things that those helping grievers can be aware of, and those grieving can know about, so they know that that's normal. And I wanted to share something. I haven't shown this to anybody, but I wrote down some thoughts about grief 10 days after my dad died. I had like specific things that I dealt with that I wanted to remember, and I knew I'd forget if I didn't write them down. And so I wanted to have a way to revisit and know how my brain was working while it was all fresh. So I just want to read this, if that's okay.
Yeah, please.
Okay. I haven't read it out loud, so maybe I'll start crying. I don't know.
It's okay.
I didn't know much about grief before my father died 10 days ago. I'd experienced death, the death of a good friend, the death of grandparents. I'd experienced forms of grief and even learned in therapy about ambiguous grief, the grief we can feel for people who have not died but are gone from our lives for one reason or another. It's often due to addiction. Okay. In my case, it was the slow collapse of an abusive church community that had come to define me in my 20s. I left earlier than many, and what I saw when I got some distance made me angry and created friction between those like me on the outside and those still on the inside. That experience was a huge part of my 30s and caused me no small amount of PTSD. For a long while, I felt like my experience was unique to me. One day while garage sailing with my dad and my oldest son, my dad told me about his own experience with an abusive church, how he'd been dressed down by a pastor who accused him of being divisive and dangerous to the church. He left shortly after, and the church collapsed not long after that under the weight of the abusive leadership. He knew how that felt, and it meant so much to me to hear it from him. He knew that my trust issues with pastors, churches, and theology were okay, and was proud of me for leaving and helping others leave. When my father died 10 days ago, I started a new grief journey, one with entirely different landmarks than what I'd experienced before. Here's a small detail. I've cried before, but I've never cried the way I did when my dad died. I cried for days, and when I wasn't crying, I was on the verge of crying. Last night, I went to a movie, and though I rarely cry at movies, I'm still pretty raw emotionally, and I teared up a bit during one scene, which meant that the skin at the corners of my eyes stung for long after the tears stopped. I've cried and fallen asleep with dried tears on my skin and washed those dried tears off in the morning so much that the salt of the tears wore down the top layer of skin at the corners of my eyes, leaving it raw and vulnerable. I've begun applying small amounts of moisturizer to the corners of my eyes in hopes of preventing pain the next time I cry. 2 days after my father died, I went to see a movie. While waiting for my sister to get there with her partner, I took some photos in a photo booth, and I told my wife, I'm going to go put these in the car. When I returned, my wife asked, where are your sister and her partner? I was confused, but soon we figured out that even though in my head I'd said to her, I'm going to go put these in the car, what my mouth had said was, my sister and her partner just got here. I'm going to go greet them. And I don't think we can cut it if we need to, but I'll share. I wrote a little review of that. So I went to go see, it was a Jurassic World movie. I went to go see it at the same theater where my dad had taken me to see Jurassic Park when I was 11. So, So I wrote this part I did share. I put this on Letterboxd. So my review of the movie was, quote, changes like death. You don't know what it looks like until you're standing at the gates, unquote. 10 minutes into the new Jurassic Park, and Ian Malcolm got me to cry. I saw the gates this week. When I was there we go. When I was 11, my dad took me to the first Jurassic Park. Kids at baseball practice were talking about it that day, but I hadn't heard of it. My dad took me as a surprise to the Alderwood 7. It was my first PG-13 movie, my first THX sound experience, the loudest movie I'd ever seen. In the quiet moment, sometimes I heard dinosaur roars from the next theater over. My dad watched it before taking me and covered my eyes when the lawyer is eaten off the toilet. That day was one of the best moments of my life, just me and my dad sharing a mind-blowing experience. The Alderwood 7 was brand new when Jurassic Park came out. It's still standing. And I went there this morning to see this new Jurassic Park movie. I sat in the theater crying occasionally, remembering being 11 and my dad sitting to my right. My dad doesn't need to cover my eyes anymore, but I'd give anything to have him here to do that again. Mm. He died 2 days ago, 10 days after surgery complications. I'd flown to be with him after the complications and spent 5 days with him. When I left, we were told he could be going home in as little as 2 more days. It was going to be okay. We thought life had found a way. Instead, chaos won. Until 2 days ago, I didn't know what death would look like. It's not being eaten off the toilet by a T-Rex. Sometimes it's a body that gives up, a heart that's been through too much in a short time, stopping and refusing to start again. That's what death looked like when I stood at the gates. So there's a few things in there. But I think the description of grief brain is instructive. That I literally thought I was saying one thing and it short-circuited and something else entirely was said.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think people understand that that's literally the sort of stuff that happens when you're going through that.
Yeah. First of all, thank you for sharing that, because it was beautiful and expressive and well-spoken and really, really evocative. It was beautiful.
Thank you.
Second, I have been to the Alderwood Seven. Did you know I grew up near there?
Hey, I live near there.
So I grew up in Lake Stevens.
Okay.
And when you said that, I was like, did I just hear that? Because I'm pretty sure I just heard that he's talking about a movie theater I've been to many times.
Yeah.
Yeah. Grief brain is a real bitch. Can I say that?
Yeah,
you can.
Okay. I can say something else if I need to.
This is a filthy podcast.
The veterans get salty.
I've never been accused of not being salty, so you'd be like, this is my most mature behavior.
We're trying to get canceled, so.
Yes. Noted. Let me just escalate this a bit.
I hear that's good for careers, so.
Oh, my.
Oh, yeah. I saw something today that said exactly that. I was like, I've been doing that for years. Why am I not canceled? Anyway, okay. Grief brain is a real bitch because it deceives you. It makes you question your ability to be rational, your ability to make decisions, your ability to choose the words you want to use to express yourself. Your processing speed slows down. You comprehend so differently. It's just unfair. However, it is also an incredibly important built-in safety net. Grief brain is that fog that really comes to us when we're in denial, in that beginning stages of our acute grief, that stabbing out of nowhere, really frustrating grief that will sideswipe us and make us like sob in the middle of a grocery store because we see SpaghettiOs and we haven't eaten those since we were a kid. And when we were a kid, our mom was here, right? So all of those little things, your brain is softening the blow, so to speak. It is natural that it continues for months. I kind of attribute the same idea to like pregnancy brain. When I had my daughter, I lost so many words. And to this day, I feel so inarticulate compared to before I had my child. And the same is true of grief. I would say things, I would have these big ideas in my head and have no idea where to start the sentence. And so I would just look at people. I mean, just look at them thinking I was speaking out loud. Or thinking I'd said something, I'm like, that's why I've noticed this is a bad habit. I'm constantly saying, did that make sense? I think I've said it a few times here, because grief brain will stay with you for a long time while you're trying to sort out all of the different pieces that grief touches in your story. And so like, it's kind of like that sweater that you can unravel one string at a time. It's all interconnected. And so you pull one string, well, everything else is coming with it. When you're trying to process through grief and you've got all of these strings coming all at once, of course it makes sense that you can't rationalize it. Of course it is reasonable to be confused or overwhelmed. And, you know, depending on the source of the grief, it might pass more quickly. It may, if you have more space to, like, I don't know, take a week off of work or actually get bereavement paid time off and really pull back from your expectations in life and be able to kind of process differently and process without your responsibilities, then yeah, it can dissipate and you can learn to cope with it a little differently. But it's so common, and you're absolutely right. People just think that what they're experiencing is unique to them, and to a degree it is, but it's also very real, expected from a lot of grief events. And I think the more we talk about that, and this goes to your question too, Dave, like the more we talk about what happens in the brain, in the body, when grief is introduced, the more we can recognize it, the more quickly we recognize it and have compassion for ourselves as we're navigating incredibly horrible, difficult, painful things.
And that compassion for ourselves is really important, because grief guilt is another thing that grievers often experience, that yeah. feeling, you know, I'm not sad enough, I'm not grieving long enough, not the right way. I'm experiencing a moment of joy in the midst of my grief, and it feels like I'm cheating on my memories or my sadness.
Yeah.
That's a common experience.
Or you're making other people feel bad by honestly expressing how you feel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We've got this crappy mind, like inner critic, and I don't know where it comes from. Evangelicalism does it a lot. And it's really hard, like this inner critic that says, well, if you can do more, be more, save more, perform more, right? That's that underlying not enoughness that we often have to fight against. I find this to be really, really difficult. Grief guilt is really difficult when people are practicing evangelical faith in some degree, because it is so prevalent. And they've got this really distorted view of themselves that says, I'm a terrible person because I'm not grieving the way I think I should. And the first time I hear the word should out of someone's mouth, I'm very quick to pause and say, don't should on yourself. Please stop. Because there is no answer that you could give yourself right now that is going to undermine what is actually happening. Let me say it again differently. There's no answer you could actually receive after shooting on yourself that is going to help you heal faster or differently or make you feel better, if better is even the goal, right? Mm-hmm. We just want to feel different. Better is, you know, better is also kind of a moral judgment on how we're experiencing our grief. And I'm, you know, at this point, I've just figured out and decided, even if it's not true for anyone else, that grief is morally neutral. All of these behaviors, all of these feelings are morally neutral. They're just information in our body. Our emotions are morally neutral. They're just information that our heart is hurting and needs attention. Our thoughts are morally neutral. They're just thoughts. Like, how many thoughts do we have in a day? Thousands. If I sat and tried to moralize every one of them, I'm going to get stuck and very caught up in minutiae that doesn't actually move the needle forward for me in any way. And so I think grief guilt is really that idea that we can should ourselves through a process that was never meant to be forced. And so when people are grieving and they feel great guilt, it is more an act of self-compassion to admit that you have that guilt. Even if it, like, survivor's guilt is one thing that's traumatic and needs to be addressed from that perspective. And so I just wanted to, like, separate the two, because I think it's different than what you're talking about. Like, I had a lot of guilt after my mom died. Ooh, here's your Pentecostal evangelical moment. We were very much a laying on of hands church, and I didn't, because the last time I saw my mom, she was very contagious and I could not put my hands on her. I could glove up and put all the things on, but I didn't want to. I just wanted to be with my mom, and she was under a lot of medication, so she wasn't really present. And in that moment, I remember thinking, like, oh, I feel like I'm supposed to just lay my hands on her and pray. And I didn't, because I was going home to an immune compromised family. I'm like, I can't take anything with me. And then the next time I saw her, I missed her passing. I was about 30 minutes late. And the guilt I carried for months of, if only I had put my hands on her. It's really connected to that sense of bargaining. We've got this idea that we could have done something differently and that we made the wrong decision. When the truth is, like, we had no control. Zero control.
You write about Job in the book and how the church so consistently misses the grief story in that and right. makes it about faithfulness. And if we're going to miss all that, then it's like, yeah, you weren't faithful enough, Mandy. You didn't put your hands on your mom. If you believe strong enough, you would have done that. And maybe that would have worked.
Right.
What we've learned from Job here is if he's got enough faith, God takes care of him and everything works out. Well, okay, if you don't think about the grief he's going through of the fact that his entire family died, like, I don't know if it's because that for some reason became part of the Sunday school canon that they just couldn't get into that stuff, but it never made sense to me when they're like, and Job believed and he trusted God, and so he got a family back and it all worked out. It was like, you can't just replace people. That's not resolving the hole at the center here. That's not right. dealing with his grief or loss in any way. So I don't get what's happy about that. But yeah. time and again, that's how I heard this story. And it's just baffling to me. So I don't know. Not doing songs of lament, not picking up on the obvious story of grief at the center of Job. There's opportunities for evangelicals to learn about grief. Yeah. And at a certain point, I wonder if they just don't want to learn about grief.
Well, I will say this, and Dave, you can certainly tell me if I'm wrong, or in your experience, I'd love to hear what you think too, because I feel very strongly that, like, the hardest part to get through with grief and in the church world is this idea that we can have no answers, that we can actually engage mystery and be fuller, more curious, hopeful, fully human, holy people by recognizing that we do not have all the answers, where the faith I understand cannot tolerate having a lack of conclusion, a lack of certainty. So the one of the like growth hierarchies that I have really loved that has helped me so much in my grief work individually and professionally is spiral dynamics. And it's a growth hierarchy that speaks to ages of like generations, just basically saying we start out as babies. I'm going to butcher this summary, but spiral dynamics allows us to then as generations to evolve. And so we go from very internally focused, like might makes rights, tribal mentality. I'm the leader. If I can kill the leader, I become the leader, to this very community oriented, faith structured, truth protecting group that is focused on the wholeness of the community and really relies on safety, certainty, and security. And then from there, and that's really where most religion lives. But from that, you go into this back into a spiral as you're expanding and growing to another level that then is more individually focused and says, yeah, I can take that with me, but I'm also really focusing on myself and entrepreneurship and really focusing on like what I can do for me now that the community is behind me. I'm still connected, but, and it goes on. There's a couple more levels, but all that to say, when I recognize, wow, the church really sits in this place where it needs safety, security, and certainty to survive, I can't offer any one of those things in grief.
Yeah.
I am very aware that they don't exist.
Yeah.
They're kind of just concepts. And what happens on the other side of safety, security, and certainty? I have no idea. But I'm willing to risk asking questions and willing to risk finding some answers that might not be satisfying, that might be really unsatisfying. Like, I don't knows. I kind of love that phrase because I don't want someone to think that there's a way to do this well, I guess, or not even a way to do it well, but that there's a correct way to do it. That's what I want to say. I don't want someone to come away from working with me or doing any kind of grief work and feel like they found the right way, that they found the path forward. There's a way to do it well on behalf of yourself that is honest and that recognizes this is going to cost me. Everything we do costs us something. And we're constantly like trying to conserve our mental energy and our emotional energy. And grief sucks all of it out at once. That's why grief brain is such a terrible experience, because you're like, I don't have any, I have nothing left. How dare you? Sorry. Try to eat, figure out, remember a sandwich once in a while and you'll survive. Yeah, physically maybe, but yeah, I just think the church, I got a little off topic there, but I think the church
it's interesting because it reminded me of when my mom called me up to tell me that my dad died. The next sentence was, don't be angry.
Oh.
And I'm still not totally sure what she meant by that, but I think what she meant was, don't be angry at God.
Sure.
And I think it was that she was already worrying that I would engage bigger questions due to grief.
Sure. Yeah.
And bigger questions are scary when you need to sit with certainty.
Yeah.
Bigger questions lead to uncertainty and being okay with some discomfort and some ambiguity. And I think she was equating anger with grief. I mean, you've talked though about how like anger is probably going to be part of somebody's grief.
It's anger is part of everybody's day.
Yeah.
It's information. That's the thing. We vilify it like it's this bad thing. And especially when you can say, don't let the sun go down on your anger, right? If we can scripture it, then we can proof text that we were correct and this is a bad thing. Yeah, but we can't.
Another version of that verse. What's the word? Another
translation.
Translations. Don't let the sun go down on your grievances.
Mm, yeah. Okay. Exactly.
But
the idea that we no, you're fine. We moralize our emotions because we think that because we moralize everything in life and we assign good and bad. And when we categorize things, they become safe because we can understand them and we can become certain about them. When the truth is, I see boxes like that and I lose my mind because it is so dismissive, number one, of the expansive nature of God, in my opinion. My experience of God is never ending. I cannot know. It is unknowable to me. As much as I can say that I can know or can trust what I know, right? But the moralizing of our emotions just disallows us from engaging them. It means we have to minimize and fit into this box right along with everything else. And we say that we're really good at this or we're really bad at this. And I mean, even our kids do it. And I've been very careful with our daughter to say, like, you're not a good kid or a bad kid. You are a kid.
Yep.
You're a wonderful child. But you're not good. You're not bad. You exist. Let's figure out who you are. Like you are, you're bigger than the binary of good and bad. And the same is true of our emotions. The moment we can say, I am not angry, I have anger. We get to say, oh, wow, I have anger. Why am I so angry? That becomes that curiosity shift that allows our triggers to become information as well. And it's not an easy process. I'm saying it kind of like in a way, like all we have to do is say it differently and then it's easy to approach. I don't believe that because some of my triggers, shoot, I was in counseling for 3.5 years over one individual that made me so angry. I wanted to commit horrible crimes, like horrible things, and would find myself saying horrible things in my head and fighting with this person in my head. And I realized, wow, this anger is really unproductive. How can I use it as information to allow it to become productive? Because that's not always necessary. Like emotions can be and should often be unproductive. We don't have to turn it into something. But after 3.5 years of feeling that anger and realizing it was destroying me, I wanted to treat it as information instead of as a moralized tool where I was like, oh, well, it's righteous anger because he's unjust. It's so easy. It's like, it's so easy to spiritualize what you're experiencing and just write it off. Like, it's okay because, but God at the end of it.
Yeah.
And it steals our human experience. It steals our opportunity to really lean into who we are in creation, like who we are as individuals and as humans, and it steals our ability to engage with any faith practice that we have that is authentic, that is approachable. It makes it unapproachable when we think we have to be this specific type of person or really take on a form that we were never intended to take on before we can approach it.
We should probably wrap it up soon, but I think a lot of that, you know, like don't get angry, you know, like look for a cutoff, make it a linear process. A lot of it is assuming that everything about grief is inherently bad and destructive and a negative part of human existence. It's a universal part of human existence. It's a transformative experience, and it can have a positive effect on us. We've talked in the past on this about the conversation with Stephen Colbert and Anderson Cooper. Look that up if you haven't watched it. You write in the book, grief can become a moment of ingrained trauma to which you never return but repeatedly experience. It can also be an opening to celebrate life and transform the very core of who we are into a more integrated, generous, and open-hearted human. Colbert would talk about, like, it gave him a superpower of empathy, being capable of being there and recognizing grief in others and being able to be there to hold space for them better than if he hadn't experienced it prior. It changes, it transforms. I feel like I'm a more empathetic person because of my experience with grief that I'm still experiencing. The spikes are less frequent than they were at the beginning, but I'm still going through it. You know, I started to cry reading that thing earlier. Grief is not something that we need to fear to the point of shutting down our ability to experience it. Right. It can have a really positive impact on us as well. So
yeah. It can.
Not something we graduate from.
No, never. I like to say that life and grief are two sides of the same coin. At some point, it flips for all of us. And this idea that we can live life without grieving or without experiencing grief is just naive. It's just wishful thinking. And I can't begrudge anyone for wanting that. I wanted it. I want it all the time. I mean, we talked earlier about the deconstruction community. Anybody who is wrestling with their beliefs or unpacking and trying to strip down what they hold on to does not desire to be in that ambiguous, confusing place. We want to go back to a season where stability, safety, and certainty really made sense, or security made sense, because it was safe. It was an easy place to exist. And so complexity of grief is not, it's not an island we have to occupy.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here, Mandy. This is one of the greatest conversations I think I've ever had on grief. I mean,
well, shoot.
You know, we did have a good one earlier in our podcast run, but yeah, just really appreciate your empathy, your story, and how you like to guide people through the process and help people out. And your book, Restorative Grief, I think can help people out. There's like a 31-day reading course that if people want to get your book and pick it up, and it's not preachy. I was going to mention earlier, you know, you have a couple poems in there. There's some poetry. You write so well, and it just helps people to sit and deal with it honestly and truthfully with where they're at. So thank you for doing this work and putting this out in the world where people can hopefully get a lot of help from it.
So, thank you for saying all of that. That means a lot. I really appreciate it.
I really love this topic, and not everybody does. It can be
uncomfortable.
But I've done my best to make it a continuing theme of this podcast, I think, whether I realize it or not.
It's important. It's
a big part of me these days. Yep. So it comes out.
And it's not only a part of life. I think, as we mentioned in this conversation, just where things are at in our country, where things are going. There's a lot of grief out there.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff happening. So it's important to talk about. Before we go, Mandy, do you want to tell people where they can get the book and also where to find you on social media and your podcasts and all of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So everything is linked really easily on my website, mandykpart.com. The book is available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And I'm on Twitter all the time and Instagram under @MandyKPart. And the podcast is Restorative Grief with Mandy Capehart, and that's on all the platforms too.
It's a great, very digestible podcast. She's not doing 90-minute episodes like we are occasionally getting.
Like the veterans of Cold War.
Yeah. I'm sorry. We try to make it a little shorter sometimes, but it doesn't always work out. Yeah. The conversations are just too good sometimes. But you know, Mandy has a mix of stuff from even under 10 minutes sometimes.
Yeah.
Just
that
really
was on purpose.
helpful nuggets of wisdom and stuff that relates directly to specific areas of grief. Just a few weeks ago, she was talking about FOMO as an expression of anticipatory grief. And I was like, oh, yeah, of course. it really struck me. So things like that are really helpful. I'd recommend it.
Yay.
Yeah. Thank you for being here.
Heck yeah. Thanks for having me.
Everybody out there, go get Mandy Capehart's book, Restorative Grief. And this has been another episode of Veterans of Culture Wars. Thank you so much for listening to us. Wherever you get podcasts, please leave us a rating and a review, as that helps others find our show. You can check us out on Twitter, our show pod at VCW Pod. I am at DJ Lester. Zach is at Muzak. And he also has a website with his music and his art. And I think he has a sale going on, maybe still, muzak.bandcamp.com. Zach, you still have a sale?
No, I just added the ability for people to pay half price if they get everything all at once.
Cool. And we have some merchandise out there. If you want to buy a VCW mug or sweatshirt or t-shirt or something.
Yeah, it's Etsy. The store name is VCW Hall, one word.
Thank you so much for listening.
And remember, as always, the podcast is free, but you still have to tithe 10%.